Welcome, great patriotic friends, to October 25th on Joe's Daily U.S. History Lesson. It is I, your host, Joseph DeCristoforo. And one of the reasons why I do this show is because Americans, unlike just about everybody else in the world, fly our flag everywhere. Awesome. I assembled this podcast in a tool shed in my backyard in La Mesa, California, right next to America's finest city, San Diego. If you're looking to move to the area or if you have any questions about real estate, check out TeresaLovesRealEstate.com. Because as a full-service Encinitas and San Diego real estate professional, Teresa works with buyers, sellers, and investors in real estate transactions. So check it out, TeresaLovesRealEstate.com. And now let's begin the show as we customarily do with a Pledge of Allegiance. Let's everybody stand up, face the flags if we have one, put our right hands over our hearts, and begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. All right. And now on today's headlines. The Cuban Missile Crisis Part 4 Plus. Well, wish a happy anniversary to John and Abigail Adams. And for you fans of the Industrial Revolution, you probably know who Philip Hone is. I'll talk about him. All right, so now here I go. Back to 1962 again. The Cuban Missile Crisis Part 4, Day 10, Bucharest crossed the line. President Kennedy ordered a quarantine to encircle Cuba to prevent Moscow from sending ships there. Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev told Kennedy that he considered the quarantine an act of aggression and his ships would continue to Cuba. However, Khrushchev would order 15 of those ships carrying weapons to turn around. Meanwhile, Kennedy learned that some of the nuclear missiles were ready to be launched in Cuba, and more were nearing completion. He issued a memorandum that authorized the loading of nuclear weapons onto aircraft. And global destruction seemed imminent. In China, 650 million people sided with Cuba. Western Europe sided with the U.S. At the United Nations, during a debate at the Security Council, U.S. Ambassador Adler Stevens, normally cool under pressure, blew his top and angrily confronted his Soviet counterpart, Valerian Zorin, with photographic evidence of missiles in Cuba. In the seas, the Bucharest continued its way. American destroyers USS Essex and USS Gearing engaged in interception. The world held its breath. The American ships, however, did not seize the Soviet ship, hoping and assuming it wasn't carrying weapons. The gamble paid off. The Bucharest was only an oil supply ship. The crisis was over for the moment. To be continued. 1764. Happy anniversary, John and Abigail Adams. When we think of first couples in the White House, we often think of John and Jackie Kennedy, maybe Ron and Nancy Reagan, FDR and Eleanor. But the timeless love between John and Abby is forever as detailed through over 1,100 letters of correspondences that probably make this relationship the most romantic that ever hit the White House. John may have gone down in American history as a signer of the Declaration of Independence more predominantly than his quote-unquote failed presidency, which is often spouted by those who just don't understand that by keeping a young America out of another war with Great Britain while trying to please the French at the same time was not an easy task. Abby's contribution to history as intellectually brilliant, not only the perfect housewife, but also very well versed in theology and philosophy, John could not have picked a better friend or advisor. Quote, "You who have always softened and warmed my heart shall restore my benevolence as well as my health and tranquility of mind," he told her right before they married. John Adams met Abigail Smith when he was a young lawyer at 23 and she was 14. He would often stay at her father's house when he was away on business. By the time Abby turned 19, she was so in love with John that there was no doubt their hearts were cast of the same stone, as she once told him. Women weren't even allowed to think for themselves in the 18th century, and she probably knew more about politics than any of her male contemporaries, and John loved her all the more for it. While her husband was away at Philadelphia, trying to get this new young nation of America in gear, 30-year-old Abby stayed at home at Braintree, Massachusetts, rearing four children. Quote, "The little folks are very sick and puke every morning, but after that they are comfortable," she wrote John when they were little, and she continues. Every expression of tenderness is a cordial to my heart. Unimportant as they are to the rest of the world, to me they are everything." Unquote. But John was so deeply involved with the Continental Congress, it was great that Abbey was there to help him untangle the complex personalities of all these men. After going from Philadelphia to New York to Europe, the 10-year distance that took its toll on John and Abbey was too much, and in the mid-1780s, John sent for her to join him in France. Abbey was 40 now, and had barely been outside of Massachusetts, let alone Europe. And she wasn't ready. Quote, "Can we draw a veil over the guilty cause or refrain from comparing a country grown old in debauchery and lewdness with the wise laws and institutions of one wherein marriage is considered as holy and honorable and blah, blah, blah." Anyway, yeah, Abby didn't like France. Abby changed her mind about France once she was there and saw a ballet. All the singing and dancing, and skin tights and short skirts was considered morally appalling to pretty much any New Englander, but Abby went in with an open mind and loved it. When they returned home to America, John Adams had been elected the second president of the United States, and his wife's health, which is never really that robust, became worse. Quote, "What will become of you, I know not. How will you be able to live is past my comprehension," John wrote to her. The kids, all four of them, including John Jr., were still sickly and had seen better days. Abigail Jr., or Nabby as she was nicknamed, was born 1765, followed by younger bratty little brother John Quincy Adams, born 1767, finally Susanna and Charles, 1768 and 1770 respectively. And then two other children were stillborn. Abigail Adams, who was genuinely close with Martha Washington, turned out to be as fine of a first lady as Martha was. Though she didn't verbally engage with the male diplomats who came into the White House, since opposite sex communication was very much looked down upon unless it was in written text, she did great, making them feel comfortable. She couldn't show up for her husband's presidential inauguration because she was busy trying to nurse the president's mom back to health, which would eventually prove futile. She was also taking care of Nabby's kids, making Abby a very busy grandmother. Not a lot of interesting stories surround the kids, except for, of course, John Quincy, who would become president someday. Abigail Adams, one of America's first real feminists, had a personality to be reckoned with, which is the exact firepower John needed to entrust her as his sole mate. If by now you've heard all this and you still don't think that the relationship between John and Abby Adams is the most romantic, I'd like you to show me another couple who's had a more loving relationship. By the way, infidelity doesn't count, so that pretty much throws out JFK and Jackie. John Adams wrapped it all up with a note to his beautiful wife, saying, quote, "It is fit and proper that you and I should retire together, and not one before the other." He would sign the letter, "I am with unabated confidence and affection. Yours truly, John Adams." 1780. Happy birthday, diary writer Philip Hone. He wasn't a very interesting person. He did have a lot of wealth, and the highlight of his career might have been when he was mayor of New York for a whole whopping 1 year. But I bring him up because he wrote a lot of interesting information about the Industrial Revolution that keeps historians plugged into the events at the time. According to the American Heritage, Davy Crockett called him one of the politest men he ever did see, while he called Crockett a coonskin congressman. Hone made his fortune through auctions, and as he would write, he would note the rapid expansion of technological advances. One thing he wrote that stood out to me personally, he said, "The world is going so fast. Railroads, steamers, pickets, race against time. Oh, the good old days of heavy post coaches and speed at the rate of 6 miles an hour." Other than being scared of technology, apparently, he did talk about other things as well, such as a fight that once broke out in front of a hotel he was staying at between the editor of the Evening Post and the editor of Commercial Advertising that involved a cowskin whip. Interestingly enough, he also wrote of his dislike of Andrew Jackson, yet he was great friends with not only Martin Van Buren, but Jackson's enemy, John Quincy Adams. So, some of his other contemporaries included Washington Irving, Samuel Morse, and Daniel Webster. Again, not an interesting guy, but laid out a great perspective of American history at the time. It's a good read. And so that, my friends, is going to wrap it up for October 25th on Joe's Daily U.S. History Lesson. Once again, I'm your host, Joseph DeCristoforo. Check out the website, joesdailyushistorylesson.com. Let me know what you thought about today's ep.
What about Philip Hone? Does technology ever scare you the way it did him? I'll tell you what, artificial intelligence is scaring a lot of people these days, including a lot of people who know a lot about the industry.
So yeah, let me know what you think. You can also take a gander at some of the multiple choice quizzes while you're on their website, so good luck with those. And be sure to check out tomorrow's episode, The Cuban Missile Crisis Part 5, plus the rotary washing machine
and a replica of Queen Calathea.
Don't miss that. Until then, thanks for listening, everyone, and thanks for being great patriotic Americans. We'll see you then.